This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Beneath a Scarlet Sky by Mark T. Sullivan, performed by Will Dameron. For the 8,000 Italian Jews who could not be saved. For the millions taken slave by the Nazi war machine, and the countless who did not make it home. And for Robert Dahlendorf, who heard the tale first and rescued me. Love conquers all things. Virgil. Preface. In early February 2006, I was 47 and at the lowest point of my life. My younger brother, who was also my best friend, had drunk himself to death the summer before. I'd written a novel no one liked, was embroiled in a business dispute, and stood on the brink of personal bankruptcy. Driving alone on a Montana highway at dusk, I started thinking about my insurance policies and realized that I was worth much more to my family dead than alive. I contemplated driving into a freeway abutment. It was snowy, and the light was low. No one would have suspected suicide. But then, in my mind's eye, I saw my wife and sons in the swirling snow and had a change of heart. When I pulled off the highway, I was shaking uncontrollably. On the verge of a breakdown, I bowed my head and begged God and the universe for help. I prayed for a story, something greater than myself, a project I could get lost in. Believe it or not, that very same evening, at a dinner party in Bozeman, Montana, of all places, I heard the snippets of an extraordinary, untold tale of World War II with a 17-year-old Italian boy as its hero. My first reaction was that the story of Pino Lella's life in the last 23 months of the war could not possibly be true. We would have heard it before. But then I learned that Pino, pronounced Pino, was still alive some 6 decades later, and back in Italy after nearly 30 years in Beverly Hills and Mammoth Lakes, California. I called him. Mr. Lella was very reluctant to talk to me at first. He said he was no hero, more a coward, which only intrigued me further. Finally, after several more phone calls, he agreed to see me if I came to Italy. I flew to Italy and spent 3 weeks with Pino in an old villa in the town of Leza on Lake Maggiore, north of Milan. At the time, Pino was 79, but big, strong, handsome, charming, funny, and often evasive. I listened to him for hours on end while he summoned up the past. Some of Pino's memories were so vivid, they appeared in the air in front of me. Others were more dimly lit and had to be coaxed into clarity through repeated questioning. Certain events and characters he clearly avoided, and others he seemed to dread talking about at all. When I pressed the old man about these painful times, he recounted tragedies that reduced us both to sobbing. During that first trip, I also talked to Holocaust historians in Milan and interviewed Catholic priests and members of the partisan resistance. I visited every major scene with Pino. I skied and climbed in the Alps to better understand the escape routes. I held the old man when he collapsed in grief in the Piazzale Loreto, and I watched the agony of his loss ripple through him in the streets around the Castello Sforzesco. He showed me where he last saw Benito Mussolini. In the great cathedral of Milan, the Duomo, I saw his shaking hand as he lit a candle for the dead and the martyred. Through it all, I listened to a man looking back at 2 years of his extraordinary life, growing up at 17, growing old at 18, the ups and downs, the trials and triumphs, the love and the heartbreak, My personal problems, and my life in general, seemed small and insignificant in comparison to what he'd endured at an unfathomably young age. And his insight into life's tragedies gave me a new perspective. I began to heal, and Pino and I became fast friends. When I returned home, I felt better than I had in years. That trip led to four more over the course of the following decade, allowing me to do research on Pino's tale between the writing of other books. I consulted with staff at Yad Vashem, Israel's main Holocaust remembrance and education center, and with historians in Italy, Germany, and the United States. I spent weeks in the war archives in those three countries and in the United Kingdom. I interviewed the surviving witnesses, at least those I could find, to corroborate various events in Pino's story, as well as the descendants and friends of those long dead, including Ingrid Brook, the daughter of the mysterious Nazi general who complicates the heart of the tale. Wherever possible, I have stuck to the facts gleaned from those archives, interviews, and testimonies. But I learned quickly that due to the widespread burning of Nazi documents as World War II ground to a close, the paper trail surrounding Pino's past was scattered at best. I was also hampered by a kind of collective amnesia concerning Italy and Italians after the war. Legions of books have been written about D-Day, the Allied campaigns across Western Europe, and the efforts of brave souls who risked their lives to save Jews in other European countries. But the Nazi occupation of Italy and the Catholic Underground Railroad, which was formed to save the Italian Jews, have received scant attention. Some 60,000 Allied soldiers died fighting to free Italy. Some 140,000 Italians died during Nazi occupation. And still, so little has been written about the battle for Italy, historians have taken to calling it the Forgotten Front. Much of the amnesia was caused by Italians who'd survived. As one old partisan fighter told me, "We were still young and wanted to forget. We wanted to put the terrible things we'd experienced behind us. No one talks about World War II in Italy, so no one remembers." Due to the document burning, the collective amnesia, and the death of so many characters by the time I learned of the story, I have been forced in places to construct scenes and dialogue based solely on Pino's memory decades later, the scant physical evidence that remains, and my imagination fueled by my research and informed suspicions. In certain instances, I have also commingled or compressed events and characters for the sake of narrative coherence, and have fully dramatized incidents that were described to me in much more truncated forms. As a result, then, the story you are about to hear is not a work of narrative nonfiction, but a novel of biographical and historical fiction that hews closely to what happened to Pino Lella between June 1943 and May 1945. Part 1. None Shall Sleep. Chapter 1. June 9th, 1943. Milan, Italy. 1. Like all the pharaohs, emperors, and tyrants before him, Il Duce had seen his empire rise only to crumble. Indeed, by that late spring afternoon, power was bleeding from Benito Mussolini's grasp like joy from a young widowed heart. The fascist dictator's battered armies had retreated from North Africa. Allied forces were poised off Sicily. And every day, Adolf Hitler was sending more troops and supplies south to fortify the boot of Italy. Pino Lella knew all this from BBC reports he listened to on his shortwave radio nightly. He'd seen with his own eyes the rising number of Nazis everywhere he went. But as he strolled through the medieval streets of Milan, Pino was blissfully ignoring the forces of conflict spiraling his way. World War II was a news dispatch, nothing more. Listened to and gone in the very next moment, replaced by thoughts of his three favorite subjects: girls, and music, and food. He was only 17, after all. 1.85 meters tall, 75 kilograms, long and gangly, with big hands and feet, hair that defied taming, and enough acne and awkwardness that none of the girls he'd asked to the movies had agreed to accompany him. And yet, as was his nature, Pino remained undeterred. He strode confidently with his friends onto the piazza in front of the Duomo, the Basilica di Santa Maria Nascente, the grand Gothic cathedral that lies at the very center of Milan. "I am going to meet a beautiful girl today," Pino said, wagging his finger at the scarlet, threatening sky. "And we are going to fall in mad, tragic love and go on grand adventures with music and food and wine and intrigue every day, all day long." "You live in a fantasy," said Carletto Beltramini, Pino's best friend. "I do not," Pino sniffed. "Sure you do," said Pino's brother, Mimo, who was 2 years younger. "You fall in love with every pretty girl you see." "But none of them loves Pino back," said Carletto. A moon-faced kid with a slight frame, he was much shorter than Pino. Mimo, who was shorter still, said, "It's true." Pino dismissed them both. "You are clearly not romantics." "What are they doing over there?" Carletto asked, pointing at crews of men working outside the Duomo. Some were placing wooden cutouts in the cavities where the cathedral's stained glass windows normally hung. Others were transferring sandbags from lorries to a growing wall around the base of the cathedral. Still more were erecting spotlights under the watchful eyes of a knot of priests who stood near the cathedral's central double doors. "I'll go find out," Pino said. "Not before I do," his little brother said, and took off toward the workers. "Everything's a competition with Mimo," Carletto said. "He needs to learn to calm down." Pino laughed, then said over his shoulder, "If you know how he can do that, tell my mother." Looping past the laborers, Pino went straight to the priests and tapped one on the shoulder. "Excuse me, father." The cleric, in his mid-twenties, was as tall as Pino, but heavier. He turned, looked at the teen from the ground up, seeing his new shoes, the gray linen pants, the crisp white shirt, and a green foulard tie his mother had given him for his birthday, and then stared intently into Pino's eyes, as if he could look inside his head and know his sinful teenage thoughts. He said, "I'm in seminary, not ordained, no collar." Oh, I'm sorry," Pino said, intimidated. "We just wanted to know why you're putting up the lights." Before the young seminarian could answer, a knobby hand appeared at his right elbow. He moved aside to reveal a short, lean priest in his 50s, wearing white robes and a red skull cap. Pino knew him in an instant and felt his stomach fall as he dropped to one knee before the Cardinal of Milan. "My Lord Cardinal," Pino said, head bowed. The seminarian said sternly, "You address him as Your Eminence." Pino looked up, confused. "My British nanny taught me to say my Lord Cardinal if I ever met a cardinal." The severe younger man's face turned positively stony, but Ildefonso Cardinal Schuster laughed softly and said, "I think he's right, Barbareschi. In England, I'd be addressed as Lord Cardinal." Cardinal Schuster was both famous and powerful in Milan, as the Catholic leader of northern Italy, and as a man who had the ear of Pope Pius XII, the cardinal was in the newspapers often. Pino thought Schuster's expression the most indelible thing about him. His smiling face spoke of kindness, but his eyes held the threat of damnation. Clearly miffed, the seminarian said, "We're in Milan, Your Eminence, not London." "It doesn't matter," Schuster said. He put his hand on Pino's shoulder and told him to rise. "What's your name, young man?"
"Pino Lella."
"Pino?" My mother used to call me Giuseppino, Pino said, struggling to his feet. The Pino part stuck. Cardinal Schuster looked up at little Joseph and laughed. Pinolella. That is a name to remember. Why someone like the Cardinal would say something like that confused Pino. In the silence that followed, Pino blurted out, I've met you before, my Lord Cardinal. That surprised Schuster. Where was that?
At Casa Alpina, Father Ray's camp above Madesimo, years ago.
Cardinal Schuster smiled. I remember that visit. I told Father Ray that he was the only priest in Italy with a cathedral grander than the Duomo and St. Peter's. Young Barbareschi here is going up to work with Father Ray next week.
You'll like him and Casa Alpina, Pino said. The climbing is very good there.
Barbareschi actually smiled. Pino bowed uncertainly and started to back away, which seemed to amuse Cardinal Schuster all the more. He said,
I thought you were interested in the lights?
Pino stopped. Yes?
They're my idea, Schuster said. The blackout begins tonight. Only the Duomo will be lit from now on. I pray that the bomber pilots will see it and be so awed by its beauty that they choose to spare it. This magnificent church took almost 500 years to build. It would be a tragedy to see it gone in the night.
Pino peered up at the elaborate face of the massive cathedral, built of pale pinkish Candolia marble, with scores of spires, balconies, and pinnacles. The Duomo seemed as frosted, grand, and illusory as the Alps in winter. He adored skiing and climbing in the mountains almost as much as music and girls, and seeing the church always took him to high country in his mind. But now the cardinal believed the cathedral and Milan were threatened. For the first time, the possibility of an aerial attack seemed real to Pino. He said,
So we will be bombed?
I pray it does not happen, Cardinal Schuster said. But a prudent man always prepares for the worst. Goodbye, and may your faith in God keep you safe in the days ahead, Pino.
2. The Cardinal of Milan walked away, leaving Pino feeling awed when he returned to Carletto and Mimmo, each of whom looked equally thunderstruck.
That was Cardinal Schuster, Carletto said.
I know, Pino said.
You were talking to him a long time.
Was I?
Yes,
his little brother said.
What did he tell you?
That he'd remember my name and that the lights are to keep the bombers from blowing up the cathedral.
See? Mimmo said to Carletto. I told you.
Carletto eyed Pino suspiciously.
Why would Cardinal Schuster remember your name?
Pino shrugged. Maybe he liked the sound of it.
Pinolella.
Mimmo snorted. You do live in a fantasy world. They heard thunder as they left Piazza Duomo, crossed the street, and walked beneath the grand archway into the Galleria, the world's first covered shopping mall. Two wide intersecting walkways lined with shops and ordinarily covered with an iron and glass dome. By the time the three boys went in that day, the glass plates had been removed, leaving only the superstructure, which threw a web of rectangular shadows across the market scene. As the thunder got closer, Pino saw worry in many faces on the streets of the Galleria, but he did not share their concern. Thunder was thunder, not a bomb exploding.
Flowers? Called a woman at a cart of freshly cut roses. For your girlfriend?
Pino said, When I find her, I will come back.
You might wait years for that to happen, signora, Mimmo said.
Pino took a swing at his little brother. Mimmo dodged it and took off, leaving the Galleria and emerging into a piazza graced by a statue of Leonardo da Vinci.
Beyond the statue, on the other side of the street and trolley tracks, the doors to the Teatro alla Scala had been flung open to air out the famous opera hall. The strains of violins and cellos being tuned, and a tenor practicing scales floated out. Pino kept up the chase, but then he noticed a pretty girl. Black hair, creamy skin, and flashing dark eyes. She was making her way across the piazza, heading toward the galleria. He skidded to a halt and watched her. Flooded with longing, he was unable to speak. After she passed, Pino said, "I think I'm falling in love." "Falling on your face, maybe," said Carletto, who'd walked up behind him. Mimmo circled back to them. "Someone just said the Allies will be here by Christmas." "I want the Americans to come to Milan sooner than that," Carletto said. "Me too," Pino agreed. "More jazz, less opera." Taking off in a sprint, he leaped over a vacant bench and onto a curved metal railing that protected the statue of Da Vinci. He slid neatly on the smooth surface for a short distance before jumping off on the other side and landing like a cat. Never to be outdone, Mimmo tried the same trick, but he crashed to the ground in front of a dark-haired, heavy-set woman in a floral print dress. She looked to be in her late 30s, early 40s. She carried a violin case and wore a broad blue straw hat against the sun. 3. The woman was so startled, she almost dropped her violin case. She clutched it to her bosom angrily as Mimmo moaned and held his ribs.
"This is Piazza della Scala," she scolded. "Honoring the great Leonardo. Have you no respect? Go and play your childish games somewhere else."
"You think we're children?" Mimmo said, puffing out his chest. "Little boys?" The woman looked beyond him and said, "Little boys who do not understand the real games played around them." Dark clouds had begun to roll in, dimming the scene. Pino twisted and saw a large black Daimler-Benz staff car rolling down the street that separated the piazza from the opera house. Red Nazi flags flew on either fender. A general's flag fluttered on the radio antenna. Pino saw the silhouette of the general, sitting ramrod straight in the back seat. For some reason, the image gave him the chills. When Pino turned around, the violinist was already moving away, head up, defiant as she crossed the street behind the Nazi staff car and marched into the opera house. As the boys moved on, Mimmo limped along while rubbing his right hip and complaining. But Pino was barely listening. A tawny blonde woman with slate blue eyes was coming down the sidewalk right at them. He guessed her to be in her early 20s. She was beautifully put together, with a gentle nose, high cheekbones, and lips that curled naturally into an easy smile. Svelte and of medium height, she wore a yellow summer dress and carried a canvas shopping bag. She turned off the sidewalk and entered a bakery just ahead. "I'm in love again," Pino said, both palms over his heart. "Did you see her?" Carletto snorted. "Don't you give up?" "Never," Pino said, trotting to the bakery window and looking inside. The woman was stuffing loaves of bread into her bag. He saw she wasn't wearing a ring on her left hand, so he waited for her to pay and come out. When she did, he stepped in front of her, put his hand over his heart, and said, "I'm sorry, signorina. I was overcome by your beauty and had to meet you." "Listen to you," she scoffed, as she maneuvered around him and kept walking. As she'd passed, Pino smelled her female and jasmine scent. It was intoxicating, like nothing he'd ever smelled before. He hurried after her, saying, "It is true. I see many beautiful ladies, signorina. I live in the fashion district, San Babila. Many models." She gave him a sidelong glance. "San Babila is a very fine place to live." My parents own Le Borsette di Lella, the purse store. Do you know it?
My employer bought a purse there just last week.
Yes? Pino said, delighted. So you see I come from a reputable family. Would you like to see a movie with me tonight? You Were Never Lovelier is playing. Fred Astaire, Rita Hayworth, dancing, singing, so elegant. Like you, signorina.
She finally turned her head to look over at him with those piercing eyes.
How old are you?
Almost 18. She laughed.
You're kind of young for me.
It's just a movie. We go as friends. I am not too young for that, am I?
She didn't say anything, just kept on walking.
Yes?
No, Pino said.
There's a blackout tonight.
It will still be light when the show starts, and afterward I will walk you home safe and sound, Pino assured her. I can see like a cat at night.
She said nothing for several steps, and Pino's heart sank.
Where is this movie playing? She asked.
Pino gave her the address and said,
You will meet me there, yes? 7:30 outside the ticket booth?
You are kind of funny, and life is short. Why not?
Pino grinned, put his hand to his chest, and said, Until then.
Until then, she said.
She smiled, then crossed the street. Pino watched her go, feeling triumphant and breathless, until he realized something when she turned to wait for the oncoming street trolley and looked back at him in amusement.
Signorina, forgive me, he yelled to her. But what is your name?
Anna, she called back.
I am Pino, he cried. Pino Lella!
The trolley screeched to a halt, drowning out his last name and blocking her from his view. When the trolley rolled on, Anna was gone.
She'll never come, said Mimo, who'd been hustling along behind them the entire time. She just said it to get you to stop following her.
Of course she will come, Pino said, before looking to Carletto, who had also followed them.
You saw it in her eyes, Anna's eyes, didn't you?
Before his brother and his friend could respond, lightning flashed, and the first drops of rain fell, plump and growing fatter. They all began to run.
I'm going home, Carletto cried, and veered off.
Chapter 2 1 The skies opened up. The deluge began. Pino followed Mimo, sprinting toward the fashion district, getting drenched and not caring. Anna was going to the movies with him. She'd said yes. It made him almost delirious. The brothers were soaked, and lightning was striking by the time they dodged into Valigeria Albanese, Albanese Luggage, their uncle's store and factory in a rust-colored building at number 7 Via Pietro Verri. Dripping wet, the boys went into the long, narrow shop, which enveloped them with the rich smell of new leather. The shelves were stacked with fine attaché cases, handbags and satchels, suitcases and trunks. The glass displays featured woven leather wallets and beautifully tooled cigarette cases and portfolios. There were two customers in the shop, one an older woman close to the door, and beyond her at the far end, a Nazi officer in a black and gray uniform. Pino watched him, but heard the older woman say,
Which one, Albert?
Go with your heart, said the man waiting on her behind the counter.
Big, barrel-chested, and mustached, he wore a beautiful mouse-gray suit, starched white shirt, and a jaunty blue polka-dot bow tie.
But I love them both,
his customer complained. Stroking his mustache and chuckling, he said,
Then buy them both.
She hesitated, giggled.
Maybe I will then.
Excellent, excellent, he said, rubbing his hands.
Greta, can you get me boxes for this magnificent lady with such impeccable taste?
I'm busy at the moment, Albert,
replied Pino's Austrian Aunt Greta,
who was waiting on the Nazi. She was a tall, thin woman with short brown hair and an easy smile. The German was smoking and examining a leather-wrapped cigarette case. Pino said, "I'll get the boxes for you, Uncle Albert." Uncle Albert shot Pino a look.
"Dry off before you handle them."
Thinking about Anna, Pino headed toward the factory door beyond his aunt and the German. The officer pivoted to watch Pino as he passed, revealing oak leaves on his lapels that identified him as a colonel. The flat front of his officer's cap bore a Totenkopf, a small skull and bones emblem below an eagle that clutched a swastika. Pino knew he was Geheime Staatspolizei, Gestapo, a high-ranking officer in Hitler's secret police. Medium in height and build, with a narrow nose and joyless lips, the Nazi had flat, dark eyes that gave away nothing. Feeling rattled, Pino went through the door and into the factory, a much larger space with a higher ceiling. Seamstresses and cutters were putting away their work for the day. He found some rags and dried his hands. Then he grabbed two cardboard boxes embossed with the Albanese logo and started back toward the shop, his thoughts happily returning to Anna. She was beautiful and older and... He hesitated before pushing through the door. The Gestapo colonel was just leaving, walking out into the rain. Pino's aunt stood at the door, watching the colonel go and nodding. Pino felt better the instant she shut the door. He helped his uncle pack the two purses. When the last customer left, Uncle Albert told Mimo to lock the front door and to put a closed sign in the window. When Mimo had done so, Uncle Albert said,
"Did you get his name?"
"Standartenführer Walter Rauf," Aunt Greta replied. "The new Gestapo chief for Northern Italy. He came in from Ukraine. Tullio's keeping an eye on him."
"Tullio's back?" Pino said, surprised and happy. Tullio Galimberti was 5 years older, his idol, and a close family friend.
"Yesterday," Uncle Albert said.
Aunt Greta said,
"Ralph said the Gestapo is taking over the Hotel Regina."
Her husband grumbled.
"Who does Italy belong to, Mussolini or Hitler?"
"It doesn't matter," Pino said, trying to convince himself. "The war will be over soon, and the Americans will come, and there will be jazz everywhere."
Uncle Albert shook his head. "That depends on the Germans and Il Duce."
Aunt Greta said,
"Have you looked at the time, Pino? Your mother expected you two home an hour ago to help prepare for their party."
Pino's stomach fell. His mother was not someone to disappoint. "I'll see you later," he asked, heading for the door, with Mimo following.
"We wouldn't miss it," Uncle Albert said.
2. By the time the boys made it to number 3 via Monte Napoleone, Le Borsette di Lella, his parents' purse shop, was closed. Thinking of his mother, Pino grew fearful. He hoped his father would be around to tame the human hurricane. Savory odors wafted to them as they climbed the stairs, lamb and garlic simmering, freshly shredded basil, and bread warm from the oven. They opened the door into the family's opulent flat, which was abuzz with activity. The regular maid and a temporary hire bustled about the dining room, setting out cut crystal, silverware, and china for the buffet. In the drawing room, a tall, thin, stoop-shouldered man stood with his back to the hall holding a violin and bow, and playing a piece Pino didn't recognize. The man hit a sour note and stopped, shaking his head.
"Papa," Pino called quietly, "are we in trouble?"
Michele Lella lowered his violin and turned, chewing the inside of his cheek. Before he could answer, a 6-year-old girl came storming down the hall from the kitchen. Pino's little sister, Chichi, halted in front of him and demanded,
"Where have you been, Pino? Mama is not happy with you, or you, Mimo."
Pino ignored her, focusing instead on the locomotive in an apron chugging out of the kitchen. He swore he could see steam coming out his mother's ears. Porzia Lela was at least 30 centimeters shorter than her elder son, and at least 20 kilograms lighter. But she marched up to Pino, tore off her glasses, and shook them at him.
"I asked you to be home at 4, and here it is 5:15, she said. "You act like a child. I can rely on more from your sister."
Chi-Chi turned up her nose and nodded. For a moment, Pino did not know what to say. But then he was inspired to adopt a forlorn look and hunch over and clutch his belly.
"I'm sorry, Mama," he said. "I ate some street food. It gave me the distress. And then we were caught in the lightning and forced to wait at Uncle Albert's."
Porzia crossed her arms and eyed him. Chi-Chi adopted the same skeptical pose. Their mother looked to Mimo.
"Is that true, Domenico?"
Pino glanced warily at his brother. Mimo bobbed his head.
"I told him the sausage didn't look right, but he would not listen. Pino had to stop in 3 cafes to use the toilet. And there was a Gestapo colonel at Uncle Albert's shop. He said the Nazis are taking over the Hotel Regina."
His mother paled.
"What?"
Pino grimaced and bent over even more.
"I need to go right now."
Chi-Chi still looked suspicious, but Pino's mother's anger had moved on to worry.
"Go, go, and wash your hands afterward."
Pino hurried down the hall. Behind him, Porzia said,
"Where are you going, Mimo? You're not sick." "Mama," Mimo complained. "Pino gets out of everything."
Pino did not wait to hear his mother's reply. He rushed past the kitchen and the incredible smells and climbed the staircase that led to the second floor of the apartment and the water closet. He went inside for a respectable 10 minutes and spent it thinking about every moment he'd had with Anna, especially how she'd looked back at him in amusement from across the trolley tracks. He flushed, lit a match to cover the lack of foul odor, and lay on his bed, the shortwave tuned to the BBC and a jazz show that Pino almost never missed. Duke Ellington's band was playing Cottontail, one of his recent favorites, and he closed his eyes to marvel at Ben Webster's tenor sax solo. Pino had loved jazz from the first time he heard a recording of Billie Holiday and Lester Young performing I Can't Get Started. As heretical as it was to say so in the Lella household, where opera and classical music reigned supreme, from that moment forward, Pino believed jazz was the greatest musical art form. Because of that belief, he longed to go to the United States, where jazz was born. It was his fondest dream. Pino wondered what life in America would be like. The language wasn't the problem. He'd grown up with 2 nannies, one from London and another from Paris. He'd spoken all 3 languages almost from birth. Was there jazz everywhere in America? Was it like this cool curtain of sound behind every movement? And what about the American girls? Were any of them as beautiful as Anna? Cottontail wound down. Benny Goodman's Rollem began with a boogie-woogie beat that wound up into a clarinet solo. Pino jumped up off the bed, kicked off his shoes, and started dancing, seeing himself with beautiful Anna doing a crazy Lindy Hop. No war, no Nazis, only music and food and wine and love. Then he realized how loud the music was, turned it down, and stopped dancing. He didn't want to bring his father upstairs for another argument about music. Michele despised jazz. The week before, he caught Pino practicing Mead Lux Lewis's boogie tune Low Down Dog on the family Steinway, and it was as though he'd desecrated a saint. Pino took a shower and changed clothes. Several minutes after the cathedral bells tolled 6 o'clock p.m., Pino crawled back on the bed and looked out the open window. With the thunder clouds a memory, familiar sounds echoed up from the streets of San Babila. The last shops were closing. The wealthy and fashionable of Milan hurried toward home. He could hear their animated voices as one, a chorus of the street. Women laughing at some small joy, children crying at some minor tragedy, men arguing over nothing but the sheer Italian love of verbal battle and mock outrage. Pino startled at the apartment bell ringing downstairs. He heard voices bidding hellos and welcomes. He glanced at the clock. It was 6:15 p.m. The movie started at 7, and it was a long walk to the theater and Anna. Pino had one leg out the window and was feeling for a ledge that led to a fire escape when he heard a sharp laugh behind him.
"She won't be there," Mimo said.
"Of course she will," Pino said, making it out the window. It was a solid 9 meters to the ground, and the ledge was not very wide. He had to smear his back to the wall and shuffle sideways to another window that he climbed through to gain access to a back staircase. A minute later, though, he was on the ground, outside, and moving. 3. The cinema's marquee was unlit due to the new blackout rules. But Pino's heart swelled when he saw the names of Fred Astaire and Rita Hayworth on the poster. He loved Hollywood musicals, especially those with swing music. And he'd had dreams about Rita Hayworth that, well. Pino bought 2 tickets. As other patrons filed into the theater, he stood searching the street and sidewalks for Anna. He waited until he started to suffer the empty, devastating knowledge that she was not coming. "I told you," Mimo said, sliding up beside him. Pino wanted to be angry, but couldn't. Deep down, he loved his younger brother's guts and bullishness, his brains and street smarts. He handed Mimo a ticket. The boys went inside and found seats. "Pino," Mimo said quietly, "when did you start to grow? 15? Pino fought a smile. His brother was always fretting that he was so short. "Not until I was 16, really."
"But it could be earlier?"
"Could be." The house lights went down, and a fascist propaganda newsreel began. Pino was still depressed by Anna's standing him up when Il Duce appeared on the screen. Dressed the part of the commanding general in a metal-strewn jacket with waist belt, tunic, breeches, and gleaming black knee-high riding boots, Benito Mussolini walked with one of his field commanders on a bluff above the Ligurian Sea. The narrator said the Italian dictator was inspecting fortifications. On screen, Il Duce's hands were clasped behind his back as he walked. The emperor's chin pointed at the horizon. His back was arched. His chest puffed toward the sky. "He looks like a little rooster," Pino said.
"Shh," Mimo whispered. "Not so loud."
"Why? Every time you see him, he looks like he wants to go cock-a-doodle-doo." His brother sniggered, while the newsreel went on to boast of Italy's defenses and of Mussolini's growing stature on the world stage. It was pure propaganda. Pino listened to the BBC every night. He knew what he was watching wasn't true, and he was happy when the newsreel ended and the movie began. Pino was soon swept up in the film's comic plot and loving every scene where Hayworth danced with Astaire. "Rita," Pino said with a sigh, after a series of spiral moves had swept Hayworth's dress about her legs like a matador's cape. "She's so elegant, just like Anna." Mimo's face screwed up.
"She stood you up."
"But she was so beautiful," Pino whispered. An air raid siren wailed. People began to yell and jump up from their seats. The screen froze in close-up on Astaire and Hayworth dancing cheek to cheek, their lips and smiles to the panicking crowd. As the film melted up on the screen, anti-aircraft guns cracked outside the theater, and the first unseen Allied bombers cleared their bays, releasing an overture of fire and destruction that played down on Milan.
Chapter 3 1
Screaming, the audience stampeded and charged the theater doors. Pino and Mima were terrified and stuck in the surging mob when, with a deafening roar, a bomb exploded and blew out the theater's back wall, hurling chunks of debris that ripped the screen to shreds. The lights died. Something hit Pino hard on the cheek, gashed him open. He felt the wound pulsing and blood dripping over his jaw. In shock now, more than in a panic, he choked on smoke and dust and fought his way forward. Grit got in his eyes and up his nostrils, which burned as he and Mimo made their way from the theater, bent over and hacking. Outside, the sirens wailed on and the bombs kept falling, still far from the crescendo. Fires raged in buildings up and down the street from the theater. Anti-aircraft guns rattled. Tracer rounds scrawled red arcs across the sky. Their loads blew so brightly that Pino could see the silhouettes of the Lancaster bombers above him, wingtip to wingtip in a V formation, like so many dark geese migrating in the night. More bombs fell with a collective sound like buzzing hornets that erupted one after the other, sending plumes of flame and oily smoke into the sky. Several went off so close to the fleeing Lella boys that they felt the blast waves pound through them and almost lost their balance.
"Where are we going, Pino?" Mimo cried.
For a moment he was too frightened to think, but then said,
"The Duomo."
Pino led his brother toward the only thing in Milan lit by anything but fire. In the distance, the spotlights made the cathedral look unearthly. Almost heaven-sent. As they ran, the hornets in the sky and the explosions dwindled and stopped. No more bombers. No more cannon fire. Just sirens and people crying and shouting. A desperate father dug through brick rubble with a lantern in his hand. His wife wept nearby, hanging on to her dead son. Other crying people with lanterns were gathered around a girl who'd lost her arm and died there in the streets, her eyes glazed open. Pino had never seen dead people before, and began to cry himself. "Nothing will ever be the same." The teenager could feel that as plain as the hornets still buzzing and the explosions still ringing in his ears. Nothing will ever be the same. At last they were alongside the Duomo itself. There were no bomb craters here by the cathedral. No rubble. No fire. It was as if the attack had never happened, but for the wailing grief in the distance. Pino smiled weakly. Cardinal Schuster's plan worked. Mimo frowned and said,
"Home's close to the cathedral, but not that close."
The boys ran through a maze of dark streets that led them back to number 3 via Monte Napoleone. The purse shop and their apartment above it looked normal. It seemed a miracle after what they'd been through. Mimo opened the front door and started up the stairs. Pino followed, hearing the sighing of violins, a piano playing, and a tenor in song. For some reason, the music made Pino furious. He pushed by Mimo and pounded on the apartment door. The music stopped. His mother opened the door.
"The city's on fire and you're playing music?"
Pino shouted at Portia, who took an alarmed step back.
"People are dying and you're playing music!"
Several people came into the hallway behind his mother, including his aunt, uncle, and father. Michele said,
"Music is how we survive such times, Pino."
Pino saw others in the crowded apartment nodding. Among them was that female violinist Mimo had almost knocked over earlier in the day,
You're hurt, Pino, Portia said. You're bleeding.
There are others who are far worse, Pino said, tears welling in his eyes.
I'm sorry, Mama. It was awful.
Portia melted, threw out her arms, and hugged her filthy, bleeding boys.
It's okay now, she said, kissing them each in turn. I don't want to know where you were or how you got there. I'm just happy you got home.
She told her sons to go upstairs and get cleaned up before a doctor, a guest at the party, could look at Pino's wound. As she spoke to them, Pino saw something he'd never seen before in his mother. It was fear. Fear that the next time the bombers came, they might not be so lucky. Fear was still on her face as the doctor sewed shut the gash on his cheek. When he was done, Portia cast a judgmental gaze on her older son.
You and I will have a talk about all this tomorrow, she said.
Pino lowered his eyes and nodded. Yes, Mama.
Get something to eat. If you're not too sick to your stomach, that is.
He looked up and saw his mother looking at him archly. He should have kept up the act that he was ill, telling her he'd go to bed without eating. But he was starving.
I feel better than before, he said. I think you feel worse than before, Portia said, and left the room.
2. Pino followed her morosely down the hall to the dining room. Mimo had already piled his plate and was relating an animated version of their adventure to several of his parents' friends.
Sounds like quite the night, Pino, someone said behind him.
Pino turned to find a handsome, impeccably dressed man in his 20s. A stunningly beautiful woman held onto his arm. Pino broke into a grin.
Tullio, he said. I heard you were back.
Tullio said, Pino, this is my friend Cristina. Pino nodded to her politely. Cristina looked bored and excused herself.
When did you meet her? Pino asked.
Yesterday, Tullio said. On the train. She wants to be a model. Pino shook his head. It was always like this with Tullio Galimberti. A successful dress salesman, Tullio was a magician when it came to attractive women.
How do you do it? Pino asked. All the pretty girls.
You don't know? Tullio said, cutting some cheese. Pino wanted to say something boastful, but he remembered that Anna had stood him up. She had accepted his invitation just to get rid of him.
Evidently I don't, no. Teaching you could take years, Tullio said, fighting a smile.
Come on, Tullio, Pino said. There's got to be some trick.
There is no trick, Tullio said, sobering. Number one thing? Listen.
Listen? To the girl, Tullio said, exasperated.
Most guys don't listen. They just start blabbing on about themselves. Women need to be understood. So listen to what they say and compliment them on how they look or sing or whatever. Right there, listening and complimenting. You're ahead of 80% of every guy on the face of the earth.
But what if they're not talking a lot?
Then be funny, or flattering, or both.
Pino thought he'd been funny and flattering to Anna, but maybe not enough. Then he thought of something else.
So where did Colonel Ralph go today?
Tullio's affable demeanor evaporated. He grabbed Pino hard by the upper arm and hissed,
We don't talk about people like Ralph in places like this. Understand?
Pino was upset and humiliated at his friend's reaction. But before he could reply, Tullio's date reappeared. She slid up alongside Tullio, whispered something in his ear. Tullio laughed, let go of Pino, and said,
Sure, sweet thing. We can do that.
Tullio shifted his attention back to Pino. I'd probably wait until your face doesn't look like a split sausage before you go around being all funny and listening. Pino cocked his head, smiled uncertainly, and then gritted his teeth when the stitches tugged in his cheek. He watched Tullio and his date leave, thinking once again how much he wanted to be like him. Everything about the guy was perfect, elegant, good guy, great dresser, better friend, genuine laugh. And yet, Tullio was mysterious enough to be following around a Gestapo colonel. It hurt to chew, but Pino was so hungry he piled a second plate. While he did, he heard three of his parents' musician friends talking, two men and the violinist. "There are more Nazis in Milan every day," said the heavier-set man, who played the French horn at La Scala. "Worse," the percussionist said. "The Waffen-SS." The violinist said, "My husband says there are rumors of pogroms being planned. Rabbi Zoli is telling our friends in Rome to flee. We're thinking of going to Portugal." "When?" the percussionist asked. "Sooner than later." "Pino, it's time for bed," his mother said sharply. Pino took the plate with him up to his room. Sitting on his bed while eating, he thought about what he'd just overheard. He knew that the three musicians were Jewish, and he knew Hitler and the Nazis hated the Jews, though he really didn't understand why. His parents had lots of Jewish friends, mostly musicians or people in the fashion business. All in all, Pino thought Jews were smart, funny, and kind. But what was a pogrom? And why would a rabbi tell all the Jews in Rome to run? He finished eating, looked at his bandage again, and then got into bed. With the light off, he drew back the curtains and looked out into the darkness. Here in San Babila, there were no fires, nothing to suggest the devastation he'd witnessed. He tried not to think of Anna, but when he rested his head on his pillow and closed his eyes, snippets of their encounter circled in his head, along with the image of Fred Astaire frozen cheek to cheek with Rita Hayworth, and the explosion of the theater's back wall, and the armless dead girl. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't forget any of it. He finally turned on the radio, fiddled with the dial, and found a station playing a violin piece he recognized because his father was always trying to play it, Niccolo Paganini's Caprice No. 24 in A minor. Pino lay there in the dark, listening to the frenetic pace of the violin playing, and felt the wild mood swings of the piece as if they were his own. When it was over, he was wrung out and empty of thought. At long last, the boy slept. 3. Around 1 o'clock the next afternoon, Pino went to find Carletto. He rode the trams, seeing some neighborhoods in smoking ruins, and others untouched. The randomness of what had been destroyed and what had survived bothered him nearly as much as the destruction itself. He got off the trolley at Piazzale Loreto, a large traffic rotary with a city park at its center, and thriving shops and businesses around its perimeter. He looked across the rotary at Via Andrea Costa, seeing war elephants in his mind. Hannibal had driven armored elephants over the Alps and down that road on his way to conquer Rome 21 centuries before. Pino's father said that all conquering armies had come into Milan on that route ever since. He passed an Esso petrol station with an iron girder system that rose 3 meters above the pumps and tanks. Diagonally across the rotary from the petrol station, he saw the white and green awning of Beltramini's Fresh Fruits and Vegetables. Beltramini's was open for business. No damage that he could see. Carletto's father was outside, weighing fruit. Pino grinned and quickened his pace.
"Don't worry. We have bomb-proof secret gardens out by the Po. Mr. Beltramini was saying to an older woman as Pino approached.
And because of this, Beltramini's will always have the best produce in Milan.
I don't believe you, but I love that you make me laugh, she said.
Love and laughter, Mr. Beltramini said.